You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
But America does not stand still, and neither will I. So wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do.
The president's State of the Union address, a president who does not stand still. President speaking last night, but much of the South and East are standing still today, either because of the cold or the icy chaos this unpredictable winter has delivered today. We'll talk about it in a moment. This hour, we will also rediscover that one of the pillars of American White House populism is made, I kid you not, out of cheese. Andrew Jackson unwrapped it back in 1837. The West Wing TV show sampled it a few times more than a century and a half later.
Andrew Jackson, in the main foyer of his White House, had a big block of cheese. The block of cheese was huge, over 2 tons. And it was there for any and all who might be hungry. Jackson wanted the White House to belong to the people, so from time to time he opened his doors to those who wished an audience.
The Obama administration, it turns out, is reviving this tradition without the cheese, though. Kind of a flavorless administration. Also, we're going to talk about the development of a brand new flavorless food that eliminates the need for cooking ever. And we learn that the global battle over gay rights in Nigeria and Belize and other places looks very different from the debate taking place here in the U.S. But first, that blanket of ice in the South, leaving thousands stranded in cars, schools, public radio stations. Louisiana, Mississippi, and North Carolina have all declared a state of emergency from an unusual Arctic front moving down the East Coast. Here's someone in Atlanta trying to commute.
It's icy. That's the thing that's kind of that gets you. I mean, you can't, like this guy's driving a truck and four-wheel drive, but it really doesn't make a difference as far as the ice.
No one knows that better than Joshua Stewart, the host of Morning Edition at Georgia Public Broadcasting, GPB, in Atlanta. He's been stuck in the studio for the last 48 hours, unable to get home on Atlanta's icy roads. Joshua, welcome.
Thanks, John.
And GPB studios there have four-wheel drive?
Unfortunately, no, and neither does my vehicle, which is why I ended up here all night long.
So this is a very serious problem. The city is having all kinds of difficulties, including possibly even political difficulties. Where do we stand?
So the trick is you have to think back 3 years ago. In 2011, we had a big ice storm that shut down the city for basically a week. And now here we are again. The trick this time is maybe the forecasts weren't quite as clear and the snow moved in a little quicker than we thought, and you dumped schools closing and you had businesses closing and people going and getting their kids. And so you had 5.5 million people head out onto the roads all at the same time. Kasim Reed has been out this morning, the mayor of Atlanta, saying that it was a mistake to close all the businesses and the schools all at the same time. The governor made a statement and an emergency declaration last night that was more or less damage control. We'll hear more from him later today about the ongoing disaster response from the state and from the city.
And has your wife held a news conference on the fact that you haven't come home?
So she wasn't happy. We have a 3 week old child, but that's okay. It was basically sit in traffic for another 5 hours potentially and maybe not get home or come back and be safe at the station and sleep on the couch here. She's fine. Her brother's with her and she's got help. So we're good to go on that score.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the unpredictable weather. But, you know, even though it's unpredictable, there's been enough of this over the past few years that you start to be able to frame an argument. Hey, shouldn't there be a greater level of preparedness here? Okay, you can't predict these things, and the South isn't supposed to have, you know, the same number of snow plows as Chicago. But what gives?
Yeah, so that's really the debate here is, do we sock a lot of resources into having plows and trucks that can go out and salt the highways? Do cities spend a lot of money on that? Does the state government spend a lot of money on that? And what's the cost benefit? And they've just decided over the years that it you know, they can sort of invest a little bit of money in that. And we do have plows. The Department of Transportation does have trucks that go out and salt bridges and interstate overpasses and ramps and such before these kinds of events. But there's just not a lot of money dedicated to this because it does only happen every 3 or 4 or 10 years. And so the decision has been made, at least politically, that it's not worth the investment at this point. Now, we're in the middle of a governor's race right now, and things could change potentially after this second go-round.
I'm wondering how Georgians think about this, though, because it is so unusual that it feels more like a disaster coming out of nowhere than
right.
a civic responsibility in the way that people of Chicago would have to deal with it. Is it possible that Georgians think of this more as a federal responsibility, a federal investment to help out states like Georgia and others in the South with this unusual weather?
I haven't heard a lot of that. I've heard some anger at the governor. I've heard folks who are upset with the city of Atlanta. But I have not heard a lot of folks calling for FEMA to come in and help. Now, the governor has activated the Georgia National Guard, and they were out rescuing motorists this morning and passing out water and helping folks try to get on their way. But I'm not hearing a lot of clamoring for federal intervention. I think, as you say, it really is more about this being a natural disaster more than something that we need to plan a lot for or get a lot of additional federal resources in for.
But still a local responsibility. And there's one issue that the people of Chicago don't have to deal with. The dwellings, the architecture in the South is not necessarily the same level of insulation. The heating systems are different. So when you have these cold snaps and this sort of isolation, you do have a greater risk of people who are isolated.
You do, and we actually had folks that were going to stores. I mean, we had home improvement warehouse stores. We had big box stores opening their doors, grocery stores, churches, malls, taking people in who couldn't get home or who didn't have adequate heat. We do, you know, there's sort of a mix, certainly in Atlanta, of folks who have furnaces and other folks who have, like, the gas forced heat that might be more common up north. And so there's kind of a mix of that. Some folks, I'm sure, were just fine and toasty at home, and other folks did have to find some other opportunity for warmth.
Well, certainly a greater vulnerability in the South, not accustomed to this kind of winter weather. Joshua Stewart, don't feel sorry for him. He's stranded there at GPB in Atlanta, the host of Morning Edition. It's a fine, fine facility, but we do want you to get home as soon as possible. Joshua, thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
WNYC is the Soup and Bowl crew, stirring it up, cooking it for you. Our soup is tasty, our dips are good, blowing your mind like we knew we would. You know we're not just cooking for fun, we're gonna judge them all in front of everyone. We're not here to start no trouble, we're just here with Soup or Bowl Shuffle.
It's been snowing again here in New York City, and it's not a problem today, although the folks at the NFL are no doubt checking the forecasts for Sunday's Super Bowl game, which will be played outside. We're looking to keep warm during the game if this crazy weather continues through the weekend, and we have received so many recipes from you. Part of our little contest to go with the game, we're looking for hot food for a chilly halftime. We got no half measures from you. It was really hard getting our soup or bowl entries down to just a final four. Portable hot food to die for, you gave us, or at least to get sacked behind the line of scrimmage for. Our friend Dan Pashman, founder and host of the Sporkful podcast, took on the challenge to be the judge of our Super Bowl contest. Our final four, two at a time now. Good to have you back, Dan.
Hey, John.
Now, the pairing that we're going to start with here is more the sort of vegetarian side of the equation here.
That's right. We said at the outset we wanted hearty but not heavy. We wanted it to fill your belly on a cold day, but you don't have to have meat to do those things. So this is our vegetarian bracket.
And I'm very interested in this roasted pistachio business here.
I was intrigued, too. When I first saw the name of it, I thought, well, that's not going to be hearty enough. But I was sort of intrigued by the inclusion of apples. And then I saw 3 cups of heavy cream. And I said,
that gets you aboard.
That could be hearty enough.
So this is from Jay in Torrey, Utah. Roasted pistachio soup. Taste it and your first impressions.
Got it. Here we go. That is rich, creamy.
Nutty.
Nutty, decadent.
I'd take this to the game.
I'm not positive how much of it I could eat. I almost feel like it's like it could be a sauce on something else, but I will say that it is delicious.
It is delicious. All right, that's roasted pistachio soup. Our next entry, again, in the sort of vaguely vegetarian-esque genre here, what do we got?
This one is a sweet potato and eggplant curry. The recipe called for chicken stock, but clearly that can be substituted easily with vegetable stock. No actual pieces of meat in here.
And this is this looks very ricey and much less liquidy than the pistachio business.
Yeah, I mean, this might be more towards the bowl end of the soup or bowl. This is a Thai-style dish, and let's give it a shot.
All right, taste it. First impressions?
It's got a nice, slow burn, a spice to it that I really like, and the rice gives it a nice texture.
Joanna in Pulaski, Tennessee, who submitted that, did you get those impressions there? I'm going to take a taste now. Mmm. Nice, you know, a nice balance of curry and everything else. I think the sweet potatoes are used well.
I like the level of kick in this dish. You know it's there, but it's not going to take over your whole day.
For me, it could be more, kick-wise.
Right.
All right, we're not going to declare a winner of these two, but why'd you pick these two as the final four? There were so many.
Well, we did get a lot of great submissions, but, you know, you sort of threw down the gauntlet early on, John, when you said, let's break out of the mold here. Let's look for something different. And, I mean, roasted pistachio soup, that's not a dish I've ever had before. I've certainly had this type of curry before, but I like these hearty seasonal vegetables, root vegetables at this time of year. I feel like that felt right to me. And I had said I was interested in maybe something with an Asian approach. So this is a Thai-style curry. So that's what pulled these two to the fore for me.
Two solid contenders, a tasty treat to watch Richard Sherman or Peyton Manning. Tomorrow, our second two in the final four in our Soup or Bowl contest. Dan Pashman, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
All right, you love to cook, but your recipe didn't make it into our contest. Maybe you want to give up. Focus on the downside then. Cooking yourself is a real chore, right? I mean, how can we get out of it altogether?
Hi, this is Sue from Hillsborough, New Jersey. I had roast chicken and potatoes, and it took me zero time because my mom brought it over.
Yeah, this is Jeff calling from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. What we had for dinner last night was elk fried steak. And done simply, you just take the elk, tenderize it, put it in some egg, put it in some flour, back in the egg, and then in crushed saltines, and then you just fry it brown. Pretty simple, but it takes a little bit of process to get it all done.
From zero to a few minutes prep time to Monica in Massachusetts, seared salmon, baked sweet potatoes, and blanched fresh greens took about an hour to prepare. All right. Portland, Oregon brought the slow cooker to the rescue. Prep work in the morning was about 15 to 20 minutes. You write, minestrone when I got home. Shia Kostelicki on Facebook grabbed a salad from Safeway. Is that cheating, Tom?
This is Tom from Fernandina Beach, Florida. I'm a bachelor, and as usual, I had a frozen dinner last night. Preparation time was 2 minutes and 30 seconds on high.
A chip off the old block of cheese. Cheese was one of the original meals on the go, but try making it yourself. Coming up, someone who has found a recipe for food to end all cuisine. I think Emeril has nothing to worry about. Bam! This is The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
A political setback in the U.S. has become an opportunity for some religious evangelists determined to hold back the tolerance of gay marriage and gay rights generally by casting the recent successes of gay rights groups in the U.S. as a conspiracy to pollute traditional values. Some groups are taking their case abroad. In countries like Belize, Nigeria, and Russia, the argument that gays are a sign of social decay is finding a sympathy from economically vulnerable people looking for someone to blame for their troubles.
My country wasn't this homophobic or intolerable to gay people 20, 30 years ago. In fact, you could be transgender or you could be gay and you wouldn't have any fear of violence. What has changed in this country is the rabid, irrational misinformation efforts that has been triggered by the evangelical movement here.
Caleb Orozco, director of the United Belize Advocacy Movement, who reports that the anti-gay movement that is on the rise in Belize is something that has affected him personally.
I woke up and my car was damaged. The window was cracked, the strips taken off, and the inside was ransacked. But I have no choice if I'm going to continue this work to drive an old beat-up car that I have.
Orozco was assaulted and injured in an attack last year that damaged his house as well. Political reporter Alex Seitz-Wald for the National Journal says U.S. groups are having success mobilizing anger against homosexuality around the world, even if those groups don't endorse violence against gays.
Well, as social conservatives and evangelicals have lost battle after battle in the United States, they've seen much more fruitful endeavors abroad. They've seen countries that are innately homophobic in Africa, Eastern Europe, the Caribbean, Latin America, where they've been welcomed with open arms, and they've brought an agenda with them and a plan to kind of criminalize homosexual advocacy, LGBT rights advocacy, that has had a tremendous influence. It's really incredible for such a small group of people who would be kind of marginalized here.
And is this a strength in numbers issue in the sense that the numbers who would endorse this mission are huge if you count them up? But there's also an argument to be made that in a way this marginalizes the religious right.
Well, there's no doubt it marginalizes them at home, but I think they're thinking on a much bigger scale than that. And one of the guys I talked to, Scott Lively, his stated mission is to go around the world and collect a group of countries that he sees as still morally righteous, and to then form this global alliance that will come back to the United States and roll back the tide of progressivism and advocacy for LGBT rights here. So they're really thinking on a massive global scale.
What would the leverage be if that message comes back to the U.S. and, attempts to influence what seems to be a consensus growing in the U.S. that gay rights and certainly gay marriage rights are completely legitimate?
Well, it's unclear, and none of them really have a clear answer to that question. But you do see sort of a bank shot game being played here. And, take Russia's anti-homosexual propaganda laws, it's called, which criminalizes speaking about homosexuality in front of children. There was a law introduced in Tennessee that mirrors this very closely. It was often called the Don't Say Gay in School bill. And that seemed to be influenced by some of this work abroad. So, it could be more laws like that, or it could just be kind of a geopolitical realignment where you're creating a non-realigned movement in the UN that's proudly homophobic.
Are these groups in the United States trying to change the message, make more radical the message overseas, to modify it in some way, maybe soften it in some way, make it more palatable back in the United States? Or are they simply giving support to something that's homegrown?
It's a little bit of both. I think what's interesting is their messages are extremely radical from a domestic sense, but when they go abroad, they find people who are saying the same things that they are. I mean, if you go to Nigeria or Kenya, you find that 98-99% of people think homosexuality is wrong. A newspaper in Uganda outed the top 100 gay people in the country with a banner that said, "Hang them all." And just recently, the parliament passed a law there that would promote life in prison for homosexuality. It's a watered-down version of a bill that would have the death penalty. The Americans say they don't support that. But on the other hand, they continue to work with the president. They continue to work with his party. They continue to work with evangelical pastors in the country. So if they oppose it, and I believe they do it themselves, but they're not making a public statement about it, and they're continuing to work with these people.
And is it the case that the people that you spoke with do believe that there is a gay recruiting movement? Is that a widely held view?
They absolutely believe that there is almost a conspiracy here, an international gay agenda. They talk about it in terms of the way you might have talked about communism during the Red Scare, as this creeping, nefarious force that, literally activists are coming to recruit your children. They say that they can't reproduce, so they have to recruit children, and that they want to secretly destroy everything that these countries hold dear, so you must defend yourself. And they say that they've seen it at home, that this is why their message is so powerful. They can say, "I come from the United States. I've seen all my precious institutions get co-opted, the government, the courts. Don't let it happen here. You must defend yourself now before it's too late."
So their political failure in the United States becomes an argument for how the gays have taken over, and then gives them credibility in places like Nigeria and Uganda.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And what they say is the hardest thing is convincing people that it can happen there. But they've been benefited in a strange way by the U.S. State Department, which has become one of the most powerful forces for LGBT rights in the world. The first gay pride parade in Kenya was held at the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi. They've made advancing LGBT equality central to their entire mission, and you have a lot of U.S. NGOs working abroad as well. So they can point to the U.S. State Department, they can point to these NGOs and say, see, they're coming. Everything that I'm telling you is true. I know it firsthand. You must stop them now.
Finally, do Christian evangelists that you spoke with believe that the 500 million or so Christians in Africa are behind them?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I mean, there's a long history of American evangelism in Africa. So these are ties that have been built up over decades. They build schools, they build orphanages, and with all that wonderful work also comes this agenda. So you have to take the good with the bad.
Alex Seitz-Wald is a political reporter for the National Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Battle over gay rights in India is in the courts and on the streets. The Supreme Court has refused to review a decision to restore the criminalization of gay sex in India after a landmark Delhi High Court ruling back in 2009 that protected gays in the privacy of their homes. That's been eroded by a sustained political outcry that has led to this latest decision, and now only the Indian Parliament can change the situation in an election year, which is doubtful. Shobha Narayan is an author and journalist based in Bangalore. She's the author of the memoir Return to India and Monsoon Diary. Shobha, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So is this a battle of over modernism and 21st century values that's going on in the courts in India?
I would say that it's definitely that. The most modern Indians, urban Indians, are appalled at this, at what's happening. In fact, a friend of mine, a gay journalist in Bombay, was on his way to speak to college students about the Supreme Court's refusal to reconsider the verdict and try to canvass support. Gay rights activists have been disappointed and they feel that the judgment has betrayed them.
How does Indian law deal with this? Is it a rights question as it's become in the United States, or is it a question of community standards in the sense that a majority of Indians have to vote one way or another, or legislators have to vote one way or another for the courts to take this seriously as a right?
I think now, unfortunately, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, they have punted it back to the parliament. It's a question of rights, not the community standards that you talk about.
And does that mean that, I mean, I guess what I don't understand is how would it then be criminal? Is there no right for gays to practice their lives in India? Or is it the result of political arguments being made that for various values reasons, homosexuality is inappropriate?
Well, 4 years ago, the Delhi High Court had crafted this argument saying that you cannot discriminate against minorities. You have to give everyone the right to live with liberty and dignity. So it decriminalized sexual acts as long as they were private, adult, and consensual. Now this year, what happened was a Supreme Court justice, on the day of his retirement, decided to set aside that judgment 4 years ago, which decriminalized gay sex, and sort of reinstated Section 377, which makes living a gay life in India a criminal act. So that happened a month ago. And then since then, a group of people, the NAS Foundation being one, which sent review petitions to the Supreme Court saying that please look at it again and do not criminalize gay sex. But this, just recently, gay sex faced the ban. Supreme Court has rejected the plea to review this. And so unfortunately now it has become criminalized again.
Is it a credible argument among a majority of Indians that homosexuality constitutes a crime, that it's a conspiracy to deteriorate and erode religious values in India?
The sad thing, in my view, is that India is lurching towards majoritarianism, which the elections are coming up, and the main opposition party, the BJP, has its roots in sort of fundamental Hinduism. And so I think the argument that tenuous, in my view, that is being made is that the majority of Indians view this as criminal, and therefore we are upholding their view. But that's both from a legal and a moral standpoint, that seems very shallow to me. And that's what a lot of people are speaking out against.
Shobha Narayan is a freelance journalist based in India, author of the memoir Return to India. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Story of entrepreneurship and empowerment now amidst a sad sign of social unraveling in North Korea. Crystal meth, methamphetamine, which has become entwined in some parts of American rural culture, has become a casual ritual for North Koreans. Since the 1990s, when the North Korean government backed away from mass production of meth, which actually originated in Japan in the 19th century, smaller producers are trying to make a living and dull the sting of their own lives by becoming meth sellers. L.A. Times Beijing Bureau Chief Barbara Demick writes that in North Korea, meth is offered as casually as a cup of tea. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
How did you discover this?
Well, I work regularly at the North Korean border. I'm often interviewing defectors there. And about 3-4 years ago, I started hearing people talking about what they call aurum or ice crystal meth. And people were telling me that they were taking it for colds, for energy, to study, to cut the hunger. And I was there just recently, 2 weeks ago, and just everybody was talking about it. And this seemed to be the biggest business that was going on.
So it's an entrepreneurial sort of motivation here, and it comes from a long tradition of the government being involved in this sort of thing. Can you give us a little of that history?
Well, yes, from the 70s through at least the 90s, Kim Jong-il, the previous leader, led this state-sponsored drug production and trafficking ring, also counterfeiting. But they used state-sponsored drug production to raise hard currency, and they made drugs, sold them abroad, Japan, Southeast Asia. There was a drug ship found all the way in Australia. And it seems the government has somewhat gone out of that business, but there were a lot of people who had been trained in making drugs, and they needed jobs. And that's the sort of good news, bad news thing about this story, is that this is one of the few growing industries. It's one of the few things that North Koreans can manufacture. And so this industry is providing jobs and for chemists and pharmacists, but also very low-level people like the woman I profiled, who are just selling the drugs at the market.
And these drugs are intended for North Koreans, for the Chinese. Is there a chance to ship them abroad and make larger amounts of money selling on the street in the U.S. and Europe?
Well, there was a wild story in November where these five alleged drug smugglers were extradited from Thailand in a plot to smuggle meth all the way to the United States. So it does seem to be spreading. But what's strange about it is this also seems to be a privatized effort. A lot of ordinary people are involved in it. It doesn't seem to be so organized at the moment. And of course, it's going, straight across the border from North Korea into China and then beyond. But, it's also intended for the North Korean market. I think everybody I've met recently has used it.
How has it worked its way into the sort of informal culture of the people that you spend time with? And what do you think this privatization means in terms of people cutting their ties from the North Korean government at this moment?
Well, it's everywhere in the culture. One woman told me, you go to somebody's house and it's a courtesy. Instead of offering you a cup of tea, they'll offer you Orem ice, crystal meth. Teenage girl I interviewed a few years ago for a piece for The New Yorker said, you know, she was offered meth when she was 16 just to cure a cold. It doesn't seem to have the same stigma that it does in the West. And I think part of the reason it's selling so well in North Korea is there are big prohibitions against selling many ordinary things. It's, you know, it's illegal to sell rice or flour because those are grains and it's anti-socialist to sell those kind of products. But this is in an odd way more tolerated.
Barbara Demick, LA Times Beijing bureau chief, reporting on crystal meth and the people of North Korea, a private business venture. Thank you so much, Barbara.
Thank you.
Our little Super Bowl contest attracted lots of public radio foodies out there who love to shave a truffle or two in the pursuit of a perfect meal or a perfect kitchen mess. But this kind of thing is not for everyone, right, Ken?
My name is Ken Forkas. I'm calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Now, let me say that I love to cook, but I got home. It was 10 below zero, and I just wanted something. So I had leftovers, chicken and rice. Spent about 10 minutes to make it and about 2 minutes to eat it.
Leftovers. That's one answer to the could this cooking and eating thing not take up the whole day plea humanity has been quietly making for pretty much all of civilization. Cuisine is full of answers. Sandwiches are one. They're quick. Portable rice and beans will get you through a week. And add technology, and in the 1960s, inspired by the Mercury and Gemini astronauts, Pillsbury created space food sticks. Little bland, little chewy. You can't find them anymore.
To meet the demands of a long space flight, space food sticks had to be a compact, nutritious, high-energy food. That's why they make the perfect between-meal energy snack.
The lowly graham cracker was designed as a kind of superfood by a Presbyterian minister who wanted to curb carnal urges. What we ended up with was chocolatey marshmallow s'mores there. I don't know how much that worked. And an even more misguided food design story is told in the kitschy sci-fi classic Soylent Green. It said it was made out of algae on the package, but Charlton Heston figured it out.
You don't understand. I've got proof. It's people. Soylent Green is made out of people.
Yuck. Who would want to play around with that?
I was always fascinated by the idea of this dystopian future where there's gross overpopulation and there's this cheap staple meal to feed the masses made of soya and lentil, and it's called Soylent.
Well, 25-year-old Rob Reinhardt knows all about the gross movie, but it's the original short story about Soylent, called Make Room, Make Room, by Harry Harrison, that interests him. Reinhardt's Soylent is not green. It's more grayish, precisely suited to human nutrition, and it requires no preparation. 20,000 customers have placed pre-orders of the stuff, $2 million worth in total, to be shipped in March. Entrepreneur Reinhardt says he's found the better idea hungry people have been looking for centuries.
Well, it's only very recently, I believe, that we have a good enough understanding of the human body to really have not just all of the components, but the proportions, which are really optimal to live on. But there's also a lot to be said for the user experience. I mean, something that tastes like plastic obviously is not going to be very attractive.
Nope.
Make it kind of old if it's kind of bland. And also, I think cost is a very serious issue. In staple meals, people definitely want consistency. They want a low price, and they want something that's ideally very healthy. So I think that, you know, there's been a lot of attempts at this in the past. But, I mean, more so than graham crackers or space food, just the idea of the staple meal has evolved, you know, like rice and beans or noodles or even burritos or cheeseburgers. You know, if you look at all of these things, they are an approximate balance of macro and micronutrients. I mean, everything is going to have a little carbohydrate and fat and protein and hopefully some vitamins and minerals, but it's all very imprecise. You know, when you're dealing with these whole foods, it's really hard to control for. So I think now we have the understanding and the technology and especially the processing and scale to create something that's not only, you know, very well complete and balanced, but also make it very affordable.
Now, how interested are people in this based on, you know, we're getting ready for launch here of Soylent?
Extremely. I mean, this is something that it was only an idea about a year ago. And since we've raised quite a bit of private capital, over $1.5 million, and sold over 2 million in pre-orders to over 20,000 customers.
And these aren't like dieters. These aren't people who want to go live on Mars or in the biosphere or something, right?
Some of them may be interested in living on Mars, myself included. However, a lot of people were probably like myself a year ago, just kind of busy, kind of short on time and money. And, it's not really a diet thing. I see it more as a life simplification tool. You know, food is very complicated. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of thought, you know, trying to decide what to eat all the time. There's just so many options. There's so much complexity. I think it's a lot to worry about all the time, and it's just really nice if there was this option where you just didn't have to be bothered.
And how many days a week would you imagine eating Soylent?
I eat Soylent every day.
Every day. So in your world, Thomas Keller, get lost.
to each his own. I'm not much of a foodie. I'd rather be working on my computer or reading books. You know, I have a lot of interests, but cooking and eating isn't really one of them. And I think that, you know, I see the appeal as a hobby, but I just have other hobbies, and it's really nice to have an option.
Now, what's the recipe for a Soylent, in so much as you can give away some of the proprietary secrets here?
Nothing's really proprietary, actually. The entire recipe is online, open source. There's actually quite a thriving DIY community. Hundreds of people have kind of taken offshoots of the recipe and tried their own at making it. The recipe is complicated. Food is very complicated. There are 33 different ingredients, everything the body needs, every vitamin, mineral, macronutrient. We've paid a lot of attention to the ratios, different fatty acid ratios, amino acid profile, glycemic index.
What about the, I'm just kind of spitballing here, taste?
It's okay. It's kind of bland. In fact, I prefer it that way. You know, if you had something that was very sweet or very stimulating over and over again, you would get really tired of it. This, you know, it's not the tastiest thing you'll ever have, but I think that's what makes it so compelling for me. You know, I don't have to worry about how good it tastes. It just tastes kind of complete. It's good enough. It gets the job done, and then I can get on with my day.
Is that what's written on the box? Gets the job done, and then I can get on with my day?
It's not written on the box. Some people do flavor it themselves, but I think it's just the default flavor is good enough.
And if you want to kind of go wild, Rob, you could just, you know, grab a jar of peanut butter, right?
Yeah, actually, I had peanut butter Soylent this morning.
Rob Reinhart, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Rob Reinhart is the inventor of Soylent. The first batch of shipments goes out March 1st. So how long did you spend making dinner last night? Would Soylent be a good solution for you, or just kind of take all the fun out of everything?
Hi, John. This is Patricia in Hollywood. As a mother of four, I used to cook a huge meal, meat, potatoes, vegetables, rice, all of that. Now I'm empty nest. I simply microwave frozen vegetables, pour on a little bit of cheese, and that's my gourmet meal for the night.
The microwave. Here's something a little more elaborate on the dinner table in Palo Alto, California. I made Thai-style tilapia in coconut milk, lemongrass, ginger, garlic, lime, jalapeno, cilantro, basil, red bell pepper, and mushrooms over fried brown rice. Took about 1.5 hours. Chris might want to try some Soylent.
Hi, this is Chris from Louisville, Kentucky. I had a Subway sandwich, and it took me about 5 seconds to unwrap it on the prep time.
They got to work on that wrapping over at Subway. We always want to hear from you, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or find us on Twitter, at The Takeaway.
I hold a Dario, the cheese stands alone. The cheese stands alone.
Here's a bit of amazing history. Andrew Jackson was known as the first president to really extend the power of the presidency and to raise the profile of the White House for the people of America. So beloved, people would send him huge cheeses to entertain with at the White House. It got out of hand in 1835 when a more than one-ton cheese was delivered, representing every state in the Union. Jackson was polite. He waited about 2 years to figure out what to do with the cheese, and then he had a big party. Invited everyone over for cheese in February of 1837. Historians write a mob showed up. smelling cheese for half a mile. 2 hours later, the cheese was gone, save for scraps all over the expensive White House carpet. And the Jackson folks met all kinds of people that day.
We'd like the White House to pay a little more attention to UFOs.
Are we paying any attention at all right now?
No.
Thank God. Like we don't have enough trouble with the First Lady and her Ouija board.
That, of course, is a scene from the TV show The West Wing that revived the Jackson Cheese Day tradition for the Bartlett White House as if it had never been forgotten. Here's President Bartlett's chief of staff, Leo McGarry.
It is in the spirit of Andrew Jackson that I, from time to time, ask senior staff to have face-to-face meetings with those people representing organizations who have a difficult time getting our attention.
Are you saying the map is wrong?
Oh, dear, yes. Look at Greenland.
Okay.
Now look at Africa.
Okay.
The two land masses appear to be roughly the same size.
Yes.
Would it blow your mind if I told you that Africa is in reality 14 times larger?
Yes.
Well, straight off the constitutionally mandated State of the Union address, the Obama administration has decided to revive the Andrew Jackson cheese tradition, virtually at least, online, letting Americans from around the country communicate with White House staffers via social media. Eli Addy was a writer and supervising producer for The West Wing. He says it was a good idea for the show and will probably be great for the real White House as well.
One of the things that was so great about Big Block of Cheese Day on The West Wing is that we had an opportunity to take our characters out of their normal points of view, to have somebody come in and explain that if you, you know, turned a map upside down, it changed the way you look at the world. And I think the show was written to be as realistic as possible, and sometimes our own characters were a little insular. They had a certain ideology and a certain point of view, and in the same way that it was great fun and great drama to bring in powerful senators to sort of smack our characters down and, you know, teach them a few things about an issue, it was fun to bring in people who on the surface seemed like crackpots, you know, seemed to believe in UFOs or to believe in, you know, drawing maps in ways that seemed insane, and show that some of them actually had something really interesting to say.
And this is very much consistent with the historical record. I mean, when Jackson, President Jackson, opened the White House on his own Big Block of Cheese Day, he just opened a can of worms that he had no idea was coming down the pike. I mean, the unexpected consequences were everywhere.
Yes, a great big can of cheese, if you will. But I mean, one of the really interesting things about the White House in those days, even as late as, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, the place was much more open. There was much less security. And, you know, it used to be that people could just line up outside the White House on New Year's Day and shake the hand of the sitting president. So I think, in a way, it's almost more important to do things like this now, even on a TV show, but certainly in the real White House, because people have so much less access to government now.
You know, the sad thing about these episodes on the West Wing is that they do, as you've alluded to there, show us how much we've lost in terms of our sense of access to the White House, our sense of free democracy being open to all citizens. It's really not the case. And it's also not the case that presidents really don't get to see very often the real America in all of its crackpot, quirky diversity.
No, it's true. And it's funny, you know, I worked on the West Wing for 5 years, but I also worked in the real White House for about 5 years. And you know, I was a speechwriter for Al Gore and I worked for Bill Clinton. And I mean, I almost never had a conversation with a quote unquote real person unless they would bring a handful of them together to give me material for a speech. And it was very fabricated and contrived. And that is sad. And I think in those West Wing Big Block of Cheese Day episodes, we had our characters, you know, mocking the idea endlessly. I think, you know, Toby Ziegler, you know, the Richard Schiff character, referred to it as
throw open our office doors to people who want to discuss things that we could care less about today.
Even within the show, we had to represent this as unusual and not likely to bear fruit. And I think our little dramatic twist there was that it bore a little bit of fruit.
In the Jackson administration, the idea of a big block of cheese represented, you know, this was an agrarian economy in America in 1837. It was, you know, part of the agricultural abundance. It was a gesture of hospitality. But it's a much more complicated image when you get to the era of the West Wing. The big block of cheese is both, you know, some kind of weird religious symbol, it almost seems, in the episodes as you present it. And it's also true, the federal government has an enormous amount of surplus cheese, and it has had that since the 1980s.
Yeah, that's a funny thing, because I actually went to summer camp in the 1980s, and the government used to donate all this surplus cheese to summer camps and probably public schools just to sort of get rid of it. But, you know, I had actually read somewhere, and I'm not 100% sure if this is true, that one of the reasons Andrew Jackson had his big block of cheese day was because he had to get rid of this cheese that he had been given somehow. So maybe the surplus was always the reason behind it. And, you know, Jackson had a number of occasions where he symbolically, politically was trying to show that he was a populist, a man of the people, and sort of throwing open the doors of the White House to average people. And I think the first time it happened, they pretty much trashed the place. So it's definitely a tradition with a rocky history.
I'm wondering if the big block of cheese day is actually, thinking about it, the exact opposite of the State of the Union address, in the sense that it's not about the president telling us what the State of the Union is. It's the president seeing the State of the Union right there on the White House lawn.
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting point. And I think there's something to that. The State of the Union, you know, as the framers conceived of it, was really just a report to Congress, you know, through legislation, through executive action. Are you working with Congress? Are you browbeating Congress? Are you trying to get around Congress? And, you know, very little of it is directed at the person on the street.
Any advice for the Obama administration in embarking on this virtual big block of cheese day idea?
The only advice I would give is, like the characters on The West Wing, who, of course, are fictional and, you know, we knew how the stories would end before we started them to some degree. Keep an open mind and you know, you never know. I mean, on The West Wing, Big Block of Cheese Day was forced on the staff by the chief of staff. They went into it unwillingly and learned a few things and had their eyes open to a few things. And, you know, there probably are people in this White House who see it as a bit of a publicity stunt and, you know, are kind of groaning at the idea. But, you know, if you sort of have faith that even in unusual ideas, there might be a grain of something interesting, you never know what might come of it.
Do you celebrate Big Block of Cheese Day, since it is clearly meaningful in your life?
Well, I'm trying to cut down on my dairy. You know, I think we're going to need a big block of vegan snacks day.
Right, big block of vegan snacks. That's where we're headed.
Our cuisine has evolved slightly past the Andrew Jackson era.
Eli Addy, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Eli Addy, writer and supervising producer for The West Wing. The Obama administration will be online all day answering questions from you. It's the White House versions of the Jacksonian West Wing Block of Cheese Day. Hold the cheese, though. Come to think of it, grabbing a chunk of cheese is one of the simpler ways to grab a meal and go. Cheese work for you, Kat?
This is Kat calling from White Plains, and one of my favorite super quick meals when I'm crunched for time is to just cut an avocado in half and sprinkle it with some sea salt, cayenne pepper, and lime juice. It is filling, delicious, and totally healthy.
Our listeners on the go, thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.